This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Sunday, March 12, 1989, Rabbi A.H. Lappin.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry we are so very late today, and I apologize for it. I also want to take this opportunity of thanking the shop for having the shiur in their home. I think it's important to have a shiur in the home too. It was some years ago when we had a number of our grandchildren with us and they were still very small, and I have a shiurim at home, and this was a Thursday evening shiur, a Gemara shiur, and there was some heavy going and noise was going on, and at the end of the shiur I decided to have a plebiscite to decide whether we were going to continue having the shiur at home or whether it wouldn't be better to move to more tranquil quarters and have it at shul. And I went around the table and gave each person a chance to speak, and there wasn't a single one who was in favor of moving it to the shul. They wanted it there, and I just couldn't understand it. And I said, but why? Look what goes on. It's a Californian house, which means the kitchen and the dining room and the lounge is all together. You hear all the noise from the kitchen, you hear all the noise from the children. And the answer was, well, that is exactly what we like about it. It's a home, and we like being in this atmosphere. So it had a very good result. And at that moment, my wife, who was in the kitchen when the shiur goes on, said she would never allow the shiur to go away. She enjoys having the shiur there, although she's in the kitchen, but she gets snatches from it. And the home is very important for this sort of thing. And I had this occasion to speak a few months ago when I spoke about the differences of the yeshivas during, some of the differences between the yeshivas during the period between the two world wars and from what they are today. And I said, between the two world wars, the students stayed at home. There were no dormitories. They stayed at home. And they lived all the years that they were at yeshiva. They lived in a home. And they saw the interaction between husband and wife, and the parents and the children, the young people. And in those days, grandparents stayed in the home. And you saw all that interaction. It had a wonderful effect on the people. And they came up and they got married and they had a happy married life. They knew what a home was. They knew what a wife was. Today, boys go into a dormitory and then they get married, they come out of a kazarna. They get married and they just don't know what it's all about. Got no idea what it's all about. So the home is a very important aspect of life, and in that connection I want to thank Alan Cavan for allowing us to have it here, and the atmosphere is very good indeed, and it seems to improve from month to month. Now, ladies and gentlemen, for today I've decided to do more or less an overview of the subject of Musar, what it is all about. And the reason why I'm doing it is that over the years, the attendance of this group has changed. And those that used to come don't come anymore, new ones come, and those that used to come go to other groups or come to other groups. And so there is a gap. And although there are a number who have heard what I've said, and also I shall be repeating some of the things that we have been discussing the last few weeks at the Women's Monday Morning Shiur, it will come up again, but still when it comes in a slightly different context, one approaches it from another angle, and it only helps to one's understanding of it. And now, to get onto the subject of Musar, to know what all the, what it is all about. Now, the first thing about Musar is that Musar says that there is a purpose to life. I want to explain to you that when we speak about Musar, we don't speak about it as a separate subject. Musar is a subject of Torah, but it is that type of subject of Torah that, without Musar, Torah is no Torah. Whether it is the study of the Bible, of Chumash, whether it is the study of Nevi'im Ketuvim, whether it is the study of the Mishnah, whether it is the study of the Gemara, whether it is the study of Poskim, whether it is the study of whatever branch of Torah we take, if Musar is really that ingredient that must go into it. And without Musar, one cannot possibly have a proper understanding of Torah. Now, for example, the Ramban says that one can go through the whole Torah, one can live according to the Torah, and one can be a mean person and a despicable human being. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that one is not to be a glutton. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that one is not permitted to be a drunkard. These things are not written in the Torah. Says the Ramban, therefore there is a commandment in the Torah of Kadoshim Tiyu. You shall be holy. It's a separate commandment. But it doesn't give the details of what it means to be holy. That belongs to the area of Musar. And when we study Musar, we are given the sources, we are given the sources in the Talmud for Musar, and we are able to understand it. But I shall explain the details as we go on this afternoon. Now, but the very basis of it all is, and this is Torah, the very basis of it all is that God created man, and God created man for a purpose. He put him into this world for a purpose. The purpose is really his own perfection. That is, that he is to perfect himself, he is to strive towards his perfection. But it is a perfection that is within his range. And the range of each person is different. And he is to strive and to extend himself to the extent that he is able to perfect himself within this range. That is the purpose for his being created. He is placed into what was, at the time of creation, a perfect world. It ceased being so, but at the time of creation, it was a perfect world, and the world was created only for man. And man, when it is completed, the world is completed, man is placed into this world. And the purpose is, he is to perfect himself in a perfect world. And of course, the Torah discusses, and this is all Musar, why is it necessary for him to perfect himself? And Musar explains to us that if it is something with which he is born, or it is something that is granted to him by the Almighty from without, then it isn't perfection. That which is given to us as a gift, that which is thrown to us as charity, and we acquire it, it is never our own. We haven't striven for it. We haven't conquered it. We don't own it. We never really own it. And so man is put into a position and into a situation where he strives for his own perfection. And he goes step to step, step by step, and he battles and he fights and he struggles until he conquers it. And he reaches that stage of perfection which is all in his own range. Now, How is it done? How does he achieve that perfection? He is placed into a world where there is good and evil, and God created evil. The prophet Yeshayahu says that God formed life, and he created evil. So evil is a creation, and evil is something that was necessary. Why was it necessary? Because man had to do good, but it had to be his own doing, it had to be his own decision, it had to be his own choice, and it could only be a decision if there was a contrary decision too, and the contrary decision was evil. So he was placed in a position which is, he was exactly in the middle. There was an equal pull to good and to evil. And what was the evil? He was placed in this world of perfection. And there was one tree, the fruit of which he was not to eat. And he himself didn't quite know why he shouldn't eat of it. But he knew that that eating of that fruit would be a disobedient act, and that he would have to pay and he would have to suffer the consequences for it. That he knew. And now he is put in the tree, an equal pull to the good and an equal pull to the evil. And he sees this tree, and he realizes that it is a delight to the eye. What a pleasurable thing it is just to look at it. And the fragrance of it reaches him. And he was not told that he may not smell it. And the fragrance of it reaches him. And he enjoys it. And he realizes that if it looks beautiful and it smells so good, then how much more so must it be good for food? And he falls into the trap. He actually decides that he's going to eat. And of course he rationalizes, and he says that the whole idea of my being placed here is that I must be the owner of my own perfection. But I'm already starting on a level. I'm the handiwork of the Almighty. Wouldn't it be better if I started on an even lower level? And if I can start on a lower level, then that is also my own. And he eats of that fruit. And then, of course, the terrible thing happens. And I want to explain to you, what is it that was so terrible that happened from the moment he ate the fruit? When God created man, it was a case of Kol Hanikro Bishmi. Everything that is called by my name, says Hashem. Anything that has the stamp of creation and of the Creator on it, it is all done for Kavod Shomai, which means it is all done to bring this perfection, not only in the individual, but into the whole world. That the whole world is raised to a very high moral, spiritual level. That there is the establishment of a heavenly kingdom here upon earth. That is the first step that was to be achieved before man sinned. Man eats of this fruit. It is the tree of knowledge. But one must understand what knowledge is meant there. It is defined. It is not the knowledge of facts. It is not the knowledge that is derived of from facts. It's a different type of knowledge. It's the knowledge of good and evil. It's not the knowledge of true and false. The knowledge of true and false he knew to a rare degree. We haven't reached that degree that the first man was when he was created. The knowledge of true and false, that he knew. The knowledge of reality and illusion, he knew what reality was. What he didn't know was good and evil, which is conventional, and we'll soon see how it expresses itself. And until then, when he ate of a fruit, and he took a peach with all its beauty, and there's such a tenderness about it, and he knew that when he ate it, it was to give something to his body, all that his body needed, the nutrition that it needed, the various forms of nutrition that it needed, minerals and vitamins and proteins, whatever it was all to be found in that fruit. And Hashem made it so that in that there is an enjoyment. And what was the idea of the enjoyment? The enjoyment was that he should, by eating the fruit, recognize its maker and his attachment to his maker. You know, if we give one of our grandchildren some Swiss chocolate, which we have brought from such a distance, and it's the very best Swiss chocolate with the most wonderful Hershey, and we break off a square and we give it to the child, and the child takes it and he gobbles it up, what do we say to one another? I say to my wife, next time we'll give him a Hershey. He doesn't understand it. He's got no appreciation. It doesn't mean anything to him. You think he's grateful to us. You think there's an attachment to us because we gave it to him. It doesn't mean anything to him. We don't have to give him this type of chocolate. The child takes it, says thank you, and enjoys it and says, what a wonderful chocolate it is. I've never tasted a chocolate like that. Did you bring it for me? Only for you. You know what he feels towards us? So everything that was upon earth brought about a closeness and an attachment to the Almighty. There was nothing that wasn't there for that purpose. Do you know on what a level all that was? And now man sees, hasn't eaten from this tree. It smells, the fragrance is good, it smells good. The appearance is wonderful. Want to taste it. And he tastes it. And now the most terrible thing happens. Now, what was a means to an end becomes an end in itself. The pleasure of eating. No thought is like the child that gobbles up the chocolate. No thought of who gave it, of what it was. Just the mere pleasure of eating it. And that enters his whole being. He's ashamed of himself immediately. And his wife too. Why weren't they ashamed of themselves before, nor ashamed of themselves now? Before they ate of that fruit, they knew that sex in their lives was there for two reasons. The one was for procreation, nothing to be ashamed of, to create. And the second reason was to bring about the utmost pleasure. And it's a pleasure that the woman gives a man and that the man gives the woman. And that brings about the closest possible relationship that there can be between man and woman, between husband and wife. It is that that brings it about. But now it's no longer a means to an end, it is an end in itself. Is there something to be ashamed of? What? The shame that there is in that. That's what it means to him now. Now they have to cover themselves. I want you to know what a moral vacuum there is in the world. No shame about it today. That is how low we have sunk. Nothing wrong in it. The high purpose of it doesn't matter at all. It is abused, it's misused, it is only pleasure. Now, that is what happens. When you've got a purpose in something and there is an end to something, and there is the means to an end, and you take the end away and you make the means the end in itself, then it is an end which has no end. It is an end which has no purpose. Of course, everything falls to pieces. And the result of it all has been that that is what life is today among so many people. It has no meaning. That's what the existentialist says. It's absurd. It has no meaning. So make the best of it. Do what you like. Do what is pleasurable to you. And that is all a result of man's action of eating from that tree. There is no longer an end. The means itself has become the end. And there it stops. No purpose in life. And Musa is there. That there is a purpose in life. What is the purpose? Man's striving towards his perfection and achieving the perfection within his rage. Everyone has got his own rage. Now, I would like to take it a little bit further than that. Now, this is something very precious that has been given to man. And therefore, there is, as far as the human being is concerned, there is responsibility and there is accountability. Now, man is still in the position where he must strive for his own perfection. He cannot possibly any longer reach the stage of fulfilling himself within his own range. But he can go a certain distance. He can achieve a certain amount. After the sin, that is a change that has come about. It will be rectified. Now, whilst I'm on the subject, I must explain to you that there was no commandment at the beginning of not eating of the tree of life. It was only of the tree of knowledge. There was no reason that he should eat of the tree of life, because the purpose of life was perfection. And here we come to a very important element in Musa. It is Kabbalah, not mysticism, it is Kabbalah that comes into Musa. And that is that it's usually considered that the body is put back into the earth, it decomposes, it disintegrates, it becomes earth, it becomes minerals, it becomes gases. And that is the end of it. Now, unfortunately, if you want to know how far we have sunk, there are people who don't believe that the soul is immortal. They believe that with the body, the soul also dies. We believe not only is the soul immortal, but the body is immortal too. And the soul has a wonderful power. The soul has an intellectual power and an emotional power. But the soul also has a power that it is able to purify. You know, although these things are so far from us today, God has left a little bit over in each person in which he is able to catch something of it. You know, in our own lives, if we make the effort, we discover that there is such a thing as purifying ourselves. We might have been in company that was contaminating. We might have been in an atmosphere that was contaminating. And then we come and we start saying our Mincha and our Maariv, and we say it with Kavona, and we shut ourselves out from the world round about us, and we study some Torah, and there is a cleanness about it, and there is a purity about it, and we feel the difference that it makes in us. But that is the very beginning of it all. But the soul has such a power, and Lutzato says it is something that we don't even notice today, that it's got that power. But we can see it. The soul has the power of purifying the body to the extent that there is the spiritualization of the body. And that was destined for the man, for man. Before man sinned, there was the purification of the body, till it would reach those heights that the body itself would be spiritualized, as was the case in Eliyahu HaNavi. Went to heaven in a chariot of fire, as he was, no burial. Once man ate of that fruit, there was a complete change. And now, the only way that man could ever come back to what he was that the soul had to be severed from the body, and the body had to go through a cleansing and purification process which the soul is not capable of doing to that body. Now you know, when you put strafer things into a kosher container, it has to be kosher. And if it's glass, it's the easiest of all. Glass doesn't absorb. Easy to kosher glass. If it's not glass, if it's a metal, there is hagola, boiling water. There is still metal where boiling water is not enough, and where we've got to have libun, we've got to take a blowtorch. Is it a blowtorch or blow lamp? What is it?
Blowtorch.
You take a blowtorch and you've got to bring it to red hot and white hot if you can, and that is the only way you can cleanse it. There's something even that can't cleanse. If it's earthenware, nothing happens. Only one thing you can do. Earthenware, break it to smithereens, and then you can put it together again. Then it's all right. And there's a great case in the Gemara where there's the oven. The oven is made out of stones and out of bricks, and it becomes tummy, it becomes contaminated. Nothing you can do about it. Burn it out, you can't. It's contaminated. It's worse than trace. Worse than trace. The only thing is to dismantle it completely and then to rebuild it, then it's all right. The only way the body can be purified today, and that is by completely dismantling it. It decomposes, it disintegrates, and then it is retrieved. God retrieves it from wherever it is, puts it together again. It's earthenware. It comes from the earth. That is the only way it can be purified. And that is the meaning of death. And that is the Chiyas Amazing. The resurrection of the dead is when it is purity, it is retrieved, and man's soul returns into his body. And then back again we are to where the first person was before he was sinned. And there is the act of perfecting oneself, which is then on quite a different level, and which we know will one day come. Now, that is, and and speaking very briefly and giving you the mere outline of the soul, that is the foundation of life as it has been handed down to us. Now, when the first man was created, he was exactly in the middle between good and evil, an equal pool. But we today, where do we stand today? Where is the pool? Much more towards evil. Take the population of California, over 20 million. How much purity is there? And on the other hand, how much tumor, how much contamination, how much there is that is base, that is unclean. It's gone right into the body of the person already. That is where we stand today. So what chance have we got of choosing the right way? In the case of the first man, there was an emotional pull to the good, an emotional pull to the bad. But he had his intellect and could decide. Today, what chance? The pull to the evil is so good, what chance of the intellect? And then Hashem did the most remarkable thing of all. He gave us a test. Here you've got your choice. This is your test. You follow it, you can do it. The pull is still there, but you've got all that understanding. And that is what the Musar tells us. And Musar is to see this all clearly. That is the study of Musar. And when we see it all clearly, we implement it and we live accordingly. I want to give you, for the second part of this shiur, something of the history of Musar, which it is important to understand. One has opposition to Musar. You know, there are two types of opposition to Musar. The one type says that it is necessary. Musar is necessary. But they say you don't have to have a separate subject. If you study Torah, you've got Musar. You don't need a separate subject. It's all in the Torah. That's so it's unnecessary, says this school. Another school says, this school says it is necessary. Musar is necessary, but it is to be found in the Torah. Don't need a separate subject. The other school says it's not necessary. Makes you sad. Well, of course it makes you sad. If you want to face reality, you've got to know what it's all about. Musar is not for weaklings, whether they are men and women. If you are a weakling, you want to live in a world of illusion, not in the world of reality, you want to live in the world of make-believe, don't touch Musar, it's not for you. Leave it for people of intelligence. Leave it for people of bashful. Leave it for people who have a will. Leave it for people who are able to make decisions and implement those decisions. It's for them. Can't face it, don't stop. So, the person who learns the series in Sanskrit, he's extremely happy. And as I have explained to you on previous occasions, what is happiness as opposed to contentment? What is happiness? Happiness is only when one strikes the truth and one realizes reality, and this is it, no greater happiness than that. And if you haven't experienced that happiness, it is simply because you've never experienced reality. It's always been the illusion that you've had, never had the reality. I was asked this morning at a shiur by a gentleman, how is it that Torah people are so poor and they envy the rich people? And I told this gentleman that I have many years of experience and a wealth of experience. I have found jealousy only amongst the rich, never amongst the Torah poor. I've never found a Torah poor person. And I said, why has that man got so much and I've got nothing? Never found that. I have found that the poorest Torah person sympathized with the rich. All that riches hasn't got anything, hasn't got any happiness. Never found it otherwise. To that one's whole life is the truth. That one's whole life is based on reality, linked to reality. That's one's whole life. You know what that means? No greater joy than that. And so we give a verse in Psalms. Eve doeth Hashem besimcha, serve God with joy. And then it says, Gilu Biro Odo. Be happy and glad in the trembling of what you know, that you are responsible for everything you do, for everything you say. And there's accountability. And on the Olam HaEmes, each one of us will have to account for it all and explain it and suffer the consequences. And the psalmist says, Gilu Biro Odo. Rejoice in that. Of course you rejoice in that. That's the truth. If that is the truth, I've got it. What greater joy can there be than that? The joy of Archimedes, when he discovers the displacement of water, can't contain himself, so happy. No one deals with the whole of reality. The whole of reality, not just one segment of it. Tremendous amount of pressure. And so let us deal then with the only school that matters, the school that says, of course, Musav is necessary. Do it in the total. Achnosis Olchim is a part of Musav. Read the chapter in Genesis where Avram entertains the three strangers. There you've got it in the Torah. True, it's all in the Torah. It's all in the Mishnah. It's all in the Gemara. But already 1,000 years ago and more, there was already a deterioration in life. And the Rishonim, and it started already. The generation before the Rishonim, at the end of the Gaonim, over 1,000 years ago, Musa started as a separate subject. Half an hour a day had to be put away from him. Learn it from the Torah itself. You've got to be up to it, to be able to take it out of the Torah. And then the amount of learning you will do. The young man some years ago met me in Jerusalem and came to see me, and he said to me that he couldn't understand why one had to learn Musa. He said, Musa, learn Torah. If you learn Torah, you go through the whole of Torah. You go through the whole of the 24 books of the Bible. You go through the whole 6 parts of the Mishnah. You go through the 63 tractates of the Talmud. You go through the Yerushalmi. There you got all the Musa. What do you need Musa for? All I could tell him, I said, you know, you're absolutely right. You should do that. It will take about 400 years. But you're right. Do it. We are not up to that standard that we are able to do it anymore. And so in the great yeshivas, and it's coming back again, half an hour a day was put aside for Musa. Had to be studied. And so it was with a wonderful seder in the yeshiva. Came for prayers. We didn't start at an unearthly hour. Started about 7:15. We stayed on until about 7:15. So we stayed on until about 8:00. Sometimes after 8:09, we studied, but it wasn't official. The official yeshiva started officially at 10 o'clock. Then we studied from 10 to 2 without a break, 4 hours. Then we had a 2-hour break, and we went from 4 to 8:30. And there we had chavrusas, we had companion studies. And it was divided into 3 periods of 1.5 hours, and you studied with your companion for 1.5 hours. End of 1.5 hours, you changed. 300 young men with a great sight to see. Started at 4 o'clock, at 5:30, all the yeshiva, big thing. For about 3 minutes, everybody's changing, running about to another place. 3 minutes later, just learning again. Goes on to 7. 7 again at 3:00, till 8:30. 8:30, the Gemaras are put away, everyone goes to his seat. And Musa's book from 8:30 to 9:00 is Musa, and 9 o'clock is Maariv. That was part of the learning in the yeshiva. There is one further part of Musa upon which I would like to touch this evening. Now, there is this world, and there is the world which some call the world of the soul, and others call the world of truth or reality. The Olam HaEmes, and that is the world after death. And then there is the Olam HaBo, and the Olam HaBo will be only after Mashiach comes, when there is the Chiyas HaMeisim, there's the resurrection of the dead, and then of course it's a different world altogether. It will be the world that there was before the first man sinned. But everything that we do upon earth, everything we say, has a result. And that is that everything we do creates something. Now, the way we look upon it is, and I know that there is a difficulty in understanding this, the way we look upon it is, that there is this world, which is a physical world and a material world. There is the Olam HaEmes, and the Olam HaEmes is a purely spiritual world. That is, everything is abstract, it's conceptual, it's spiritual, as opposed to physical and material. I hope that over the years I've made it clear that reality is really in the intangible, not in the tangible. The more tangible, the greater is the diminution and the reduction of reality. To give you just one example, one has a body, Rachmana Litzlan, one has a corpse. Now, which is the real thing? The corpse or the person that is alive? What makes the difference? Life. Can one see it? Can one touch it? Can one smell it? Nothing there. There's nothing there. So which is real? Which is the real person, the corpse or the live one? And what makes the live one the real person? It's that which you cannot see, which you cannot hear, which you cannot touch, completely intangible. That is the reality of it. And as I've explained to you, Hashem creates the world in such a way that if one only searches and tries to understand, it is all there, one sees it all there. You know, take matter as honor. Honor. What people won't only do for honor. They give away so much money as long as they are honored. Told you the story of a gentleman that he gave a banquet in Johannesburg for hundreds of people, and nobody had to pay $200 for a plate or $500 for a couple. It was per invitation. He paid it all, but it was the institution, so to say, that was honoring him. But that was nothing compared with what he gave to the institution in money. And we were, my wife and I were in at the banquet, and I looked at that man and I saw he wasn't eating anything. So in between some of the courses, I went across to him and I said, "Mr. Miller, you're not eating anything." And he said, "I'm not allowed to have anything. All I can have is a glass of water. I've got this water, I'm not allowed to eat anything. I'm not well." I said, "Mr. Miller, I'm terribly, terribly sorry for you." He said, "You don't have to be sorry for me. This is the greatest day in my life. All this honor, giving him certificates and plaques and gold and silver trays. The greatest day in my life." And I thought to myself, nothing comes into his tummy. So much goes out of his pocket. And he's the greatest day in his life. What is he getting out of it? Getting covered. Now go and explain what it is. What is covered? The joy that he gets out of it. Covered is spiritual. Covered is not material. Covered is spiritual. And if you want to know what real joy is on the Olam HaEmes, know it from covered. Which is a very, very, very little part of what it all is. But it's reality. It's reality. One doesn't pay. But in those days, it amounted to $1 million at least. Probably more than $1 million. One doesn't pay that for an illusion. Not a good businessman. And a tough businessman. Who knew what money was? It was real. What it meant to him. Intangible. Reality is only in the abstract, the conceptual, and the spiritual. That's where it is. When it is reduced to the physical and the material, it is reduced from its essence. Not really what it is. So reality is on the olam ve'emes. That is where reality is. Everything that we do here creates something on the olam ve'emes. It creates, in the words of the Yisrael Talanta, and in the words of the Chofetz Chaim, independently they say the same thing. Same way as one has to have a home here upon earth. Some people have lesser homes, some people have better homes. And a person wants to have a comfortable home. Not only the necessities of life, he wants to have some of the comforts of life. Perhaps even some of the luxuries. Perfectly legitimate. Because in any way, in any event, the comforts of today become the necessities of tomorrow. And the luxuries of tomorrow become the necessities of the following day. Perfectly in order. And the Olam HaEmes one also needs a home. We build it here. With every deed we do, if it is the right deed, it creates. Every word we say, if it's the right word, it creates. That is our hope. Now, I cannot go any further than that today, but I hope I've given you some kind of an overview of what Musar is. Musar is not a movement. In its present form, it was started 160 years ago, 170 years ago. It was never to be a movement. Once it becomes a movement, it becomes an organization. Once it becomes an organization, then it becomes a business. And after that, it becomes an empire. And it's not, that's not Musar anymore. Don't want that. And unfortunately, people who don't understand what Musar is want to make it into a movement and have committees for it and everything. Once you do that, it's not Musar anymore. Musar is highly personal, very intimate. It is where man is in a dialogue with himself, and out of that, there arises a dialogue between himself and his Creator. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.